Hi, everybody, and welcome back. We're at the fourth annual conference for Moms Fighting Autism. We have with us today Patricia Polchowski. She's an autism seizure specialist, and welcome to the show, Patricia. I'm so glad that you came. Came to speak to our audience via the webinar. Thank you for joining us. And without further ado, Patricia Polchowski.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, as many as 50% of children who are diagnosed with autism also may suffer from silent, difficult-to-recognize seizures, and these seizures are often easily treated with medication. My partner is Karen Haynes, and she's the author of a groundbreaking book recently released entitled Silently Seizing, Common, Unrecognized, and Frequently Missed Seizures and Their Potentially Damaging Impact on Individuals with Autism. I'm going to reference a lot of Karen's work that she's pulled together through this presentation. Through many years of research, what Karen discovered was essentially this information could improve the outcomes for the 1 in 50 children who are currently being diagnosed with autism in the United States. It's imperative for parents and professionals to know that the behaviors that are used to diagnose autism, such as language regression, behavioral outbursts, can also be a form of partial epilepsy, which is treatable. These partial seizures are impossible to see with the naked eye and are often missed by the standard technology used, which would be an EEG. An EEG typically only picks up the top centimeter of brain activity, and these type of seizures are often very, very deep in the brain. So this problem is really having tragic consequences for these children and their families because language and behavior originate inside the brain, yet most children are diagnosed just using the behavioral observations. And once the diagnosis of autism is made, very few children receive any further evaluation into any other neurological, genetic, or metabolic conditions associated with autism. In a sense, we put the autism in a box and put the lid on it. And every time our child does something that doesn't fit the norm, we throw it in that box and say, well, it's the autism, it's the autism. But who in their right mind would trust this type of an assessment? But many of us do. Traditionally, when children finally receive their diagnosis of autism, it's looked at as the end of a quest for answers. We know what we're doing. But instead, it should really be the beginning of your quest. These seizures can be easily treated, and once they are, the symptoms that led to them being diagnosed with autism in the first place can be greatly improved, and in some children have disappeared altogether. So it's imperative that these silent seizures be recognized and treated as soon as possible to preserve the functioning of our children's developing brains. I'm going to share a little bit about my own journey with my own son. My son, John, seemed to have be following a typical path in his early development. He made eye contact, he developed language, was interacting. But as he approached his one-year birthday, a lot of the words he had, such as mom, dad, cookie, started showing up less and less. And instead of language flowing out of him, it appeared that the language was flowing away from him. He also started to have behaviors such that included staring spells and temper tantrums that really didn't seem to connect to anything that was going on around him, left us scratching our heads a lot. But during the staring spells, which lasted a few seconds, nothing that anyone said could bring him back to us. So we contacted his pediatrician for guidance, and he suggested we look at other professionals to figure out what else might be going on with our son. So our first stop was an audiologist. So we took John to the audiologist. However, he was having a behavioral difficult day. They weren't able to complete the test, but based on what they saw, they said, you know what, his hearing is fine. That is not the problem. That's not what we're looking at. So we moved on to the next specialist, which was a speech pathologist. We went to see the speech pathologist who spent quite a bit of time with us, and she walked us out to the waiting room and looked at me and said, Mrs. Polchowski, your son's autistic. You need to call early intervention and get him help. And that was it. It was just dropped on us like a bomb. And we stood there not quite sure what to do next, where to go, or who we should even talk to at this point. So we moved on to a developmental pediatrician who gave us the diagnosis on the autism spectrum. The recommendation was that we needed to start speech and occupational therapy and physical therapy and all these treatments. But during this time, John was having staring spells, but nothing was happening consistent enough for the doctors to want to investigate it further. We were just told he's visually stimming. He's just not paying attention. It's the autism. He also started to have more and more behavioral tantrums, which really made school and therapy difficult. But again, it was attributed to, well, kids with autism, they have these behaviors, they have these tantrums. No one thought to look any further, and we, of course, followed the experts. Overall, as a society, we placed blind faith and complete trust in the professionals who we are always taught know more than we do. The doctors know more than we do. We should follow what they say. And at that time, we were told that our son would never speak, play, or make friends. We just had to start to grieve what he wouldn't be and move on. There was no looking to see what else was wrong. It was, it's autism. Move on. As he became older, he continued to have tantrum behaviors and lots of visual stimming off to the sides, but nothing any of his therapists or specialists did could reduce these behaviors. And a few years ago, I started to read a little bit about temporal lobe epilepsy and discovered that my son had almost every symptom. And I also read about how frequently temporal lobe epilepsy is misdiagnosed in many people, even people with typical development. I was able to find some information which led me to my partner now, Karen Haynes. And after talking with her and really going through the information on the brain and the symptoms, it became very, very clear that he had a seizure disorder all along. And as it progressed, the manifestation of these seizures went well beyond staring spells. The more severe seizures that he had produced vicious rage and undirected violence that really destroyed many of his chances to even be in a school. He had severely injured staff at his school. He had injured myself. He was labeled as a dangerous child, and we were asked to keep him home from school for a few months until we had him under control. So according to the experts, reoccurring seizures contribute to nerve cell injury and death in the developing brain. These seizures have been associated with also having a decline in cognitive function, behavioral challenges, and language regression, the exact things that we also look at with autism. Researchers have noted that seizures alter the brain's complex circuitry. When seizures begin early in life and are untreated, permanent behavioral abnormalities result. Dr. Richard Riestek, a clinical professor of neurology at George Washington University and esteemed author of many books on the brain, wrote an article called Complex Partial Seizure Presents Diagnostic Challenge, where he talks about that seizures begin to come under control when you have anti-seizure medication on board, and a deterioration in the neuropsychiatric status is often seen. A schizophrenic-like epileptic psychosis often emerges as the anticonvulsants are normalizing and improving the seizures within the brain. So it's important to realize that there are two different problems that needed to be treated separately for children to experience remission and have the seizures really come under control. It's also interesting to note that these untreated seizures also can produce a schizophrenic psychosis, and this association can shed some light on why many, many years ago autism was actually referred to as childhood schizophrenia. But the good news is that it's never too late for intervention, because at whatever point intervention's applied, the brain, our miraculous organ, can heal itself by creating new pathways. This process is called plasticity of the brain. It's important to remember that these seizures are subclinical. They don't show up on EEGs, and they can produce psychiatric symptoms. And this often leads doctors to come to the wrong conclusion. When you receive a diagnosis of autism, it's important to ask the physician for a comprehensive diagnostic evaluation, because there are many genetic disorders which are very similar to autism, and those need to be identified. Many mitochondrial disorders, inborn errors of metabolism, and overall genetic disorders also can look just like autism. Many of these disorders are characterized by specific intolerances that need to be discovered so things can be avoided in the child's life. If seizures are present, identifying and treating them will markedly improve the level of functioning in our children, and sometimes that improvement is dramatic. So often we rely on an inexact science to tell us what is wrong with our children, but we don't question that science. This can sometimes lead to the erroneous assumption we all make as to why a child is lashing out, why they're screaming, why they're violent. But the truth is we don't know the answer. We don't know why they're doing that. And often our children can't answer the question of what is wrong. However, often when children are diagnosed with autism, everything they do is labeled because of their autism, because of their autism. But no one really looks further to find the cause of why our kids are doing what they're doing. So observing and charting behavioral data and trying to figure out the origin of all these behaviors is really the cornerstone of getting your child help. As part of behavioral analysis, it's essential to determine when the behavior is random. Is it an internal event? Or is there something in the environment because they're feeling frustrated or they can't have access to something? Figuring out the difference in those type of behaviors is really critical to unlocking the challenge of having seizures. Subclinical silent seizures are difficult to diagnose because many of us have been taught that the odd behaviors and language delays are just autism. We haven't been given the opportunity to think that maybe it's something else. The origin of behavior is not recognized as a seizure disorder, and tragically, many children descend needlessly into an entirely treatable condition. These silent seizures are hard to detect in part because they initially cause changes that are subtle. On top of that, as I mentioned, an EEG is often used, and that often fails to catch these seizures. So currently, the diagnosis remains clinical, that is, based on the behaviors that someone is exhibiting and the patterns in which they occur. And one thing that should be noted is that when seizures start to happen, they often present the same way each time. So you will start to see a pattern develop. How many of us have the tools that we need to dissect the behavior of our children with autism? The experts always tell us this is just the way they are, and we're supposed to accept it. So we grieve our loss, go on with our lives, accepting without question that our children will bang their heads for no reason, walk on their toes, cover their ears, stare into space, episodically scream, self-injure themselves, and show aggression toward others. Many of us believe that all of these abnormal behaviors are just autism, a disorder for which no existing remedy really will significantly alter the course. But this is not so. Seizures can be responsible for this abnormal behavior that is often misdiagnosed as autism. Autism merely describes a set of symptoms. There is another disorder causing this set of symptoms, and that fact is glossed over. The good news is that once seizures are identified and treated, a person can function at a much higher level, and some children are even recovering. Additionally, if a genetic disorder is present, once the exact disorder is identified, then treatment can begin that is specifically targeted at that disorder. Antipsychotic drugs are often used to treat the behavioral components seen in children with autism. Many of these medications actually lower the seizure threshold, which makes seizures more likely to occur. Sometimes this can lead to a worsening of behaviors and just add confusion to the clinical picture you're trying to put together about their neurological function. These medications should only be used when they're necessary, and it's essential to parse out the issues in particular that the child has so you can really understand and guide the treatment plan that's in place. Both seizures and psychosis can produce hallucinations, delusions, and aggressive behavior. So treating with one medication at a time is really important, and keeping data on the changes that you see so that you can really clarify the clinical picture is important. My son was on Risperdal for many, many years to manage his behaviors. But as the seizure picture became clearer and clearer, his doctors have been able to reduce the behavioral medications that he has been on to almost nothing at this point because the seizures are being well controlled by seizure medication. So this exploration into seizures and treating it with an anti-seizure medication has really brought both his seizures and his behaviors under control, which was tremendous for him. Often during a seizure, a person loses contact with their environment so profoundly and they can't control their behavior caused by the seizure or how their body is responding to it. If the seizure is affecting a small part of the brain, awareness of the seizure may remain intact even though the person can't stop it, and that is called a simple partial seizure. But when the seizure starts to affect a larger part of the brain and then spreads, it's called a complex partial seizure. A person experiencing this type of seizure cannot control the behavior that's produced, and they don't recall what happened during the seizure. Some people will act in a bizarre manner. They may start to scream, fumble with their clothes, start to mumble gibberish, take their clothes off, become aggressive, really random type of behaviors. And after my son would have a seizure, he would often lay down and hold his head and cry and look at me with tears saying, "What's wrong? Am I okay now?" Just holding his head. And it was so heartbreaking to see him begging me to help him, and I was powerless. I didn't know what to do. So when you look at the possible signs of a seizure, separate it out from autism behaviors just for a second, but I'm going to read a list. Some of them are on the slide, and there's some additional ones. Deja vu, having visions from the past, visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, racing thoughts, odd feelings in their stomach, tingling feelings, fear, panic, anxiety, dizziness, staring out, loss of vision, difficulty talking or just not making sense when you're talking, stomping your feet, waving your hands, your eyes fluttering or rolling off to the side, clenching teeth, chewing the inside of your mouth, lip smacking, screaming, falling down, incontinence, headaches, fatigue, making clicking sounds, and any of these, and aggression, but any of these symptoms can present alone or in combination. But again, once you start to see these, they will occur in a similar pattern each time the child seizes or has a seizure event. So post-seizure, the events surrounding a seizure are really they're unlike any other behavior you're going to see. Sometimes it's so mild that we look and just say, oh, they spaced out, they checked out for a few minutes, they're staring out the window, they're daydreaming. But after a seizure, there's often a short period of confusion that can last a few minutes or longer. The person may ask you what happened, such as my son, what happened, what's wrong? And then they may seem very confused and disoriented. The seizure can often then be followed by a sudden attack of fatigue and falling into a deep sleep. After a person comes to, they may feel shame and embarrassment, depression and sadness, and they may look around and see that furniture has been tipped over or someone is crying because they've been hurt. So as with many misunderstood conditions, depression can be really profound in people who are having seizures, and that needs to always be kept in mind as well because that piece may also need to be treated. Doctors who are specializing in treating behavioral disorders tend to have little or no familiarity with seizures other than a grand mal seizure, and that's what I have found most people have as a frame of reference, a grand mal seizure. So there's this ongoing tendency to attribute all behaviors that occur to just the autism as a neurological impairment, well, without really looking to dissect the origin. But on the other hand, you've got neurologists who are familiar with epilepsy but don't really have the understanding of the behavioral symptoms of autism and the intellectual impairment. So you've got two different specialists, but one doesn't really fully understand the other's expertise. So what ends up happening is common sense needs to be applied. It's illogical to believe that somebody would just turn on a dime and have a severe tantrum with severe maladaptive behaviors for no reason, because every behavior happens for a reason. If we are upset, there's a reason. If a child has a tantrum out of the blue and it is not because they're frustrated or wanting something, we have to ask ourselves, what is the point of this behavior. And the point we often come to with seizures is there is no point because the behavior is not within their control. If a person has a brain disorder, we need to look at their brain. Seizures and autism reflect a tremendous misunderstanding, which results when medical issues in a misunderstood disorder fall squarely at the intersection between neurology and psychiatry. This intersection can be an occasion where experts meet to solve these problems, or it puts a family in no man's land with not being sure what direction to turn, and often we seem to be in the latter. As concerned parents, we must ask relevant questions and trust our instincts and our own observations. If you believe your child is having silent seizures and the psychiatrist doesn't agree, you need to explore this with a neurologist, maybe several neurologists. But treatment must be aimed at seizure control with anticonvulsant medications, and then attending to the comorbid conditions or conditions that are occurring together need to be addressed. I have to emphasize that the definitive diagnosis is difficult and complicated because the characteristics of partial epilepsy are so often mistaken for the behavioral abnormality of autism. It is often the seizures that are causing the odd behavior and the language deficits. What's really important to note, and is the crux of Karen's book, is that these seizures and the associated psychosis can be successfully treated, which preserves the function of the developing brain. The brain can start to heal itself. But the loss of language can be attributed to clinical or subclinical seizures, which originate in the part of the brain that's responsible for language, the temporal lobe. So it's critical these seizures be recognized and treated as early as possible. Our miracle of healing. Once my son's seizures were diagnosed and he was on the correct anticonvulsant medications, he started to regain the skills that he had lost over the years that he was having his seizures. His ability to read, to write, to interact socially, to problem solve, slowly started to return. And those autistic behaviors that the doctors called, the staring, the tantrums, and the violent behavior, have stopped. Now, this wasn't an overnight fix. Over the last year, we have seen a whole new person emerge, but it's taken us a year to get there. My son still has language challenges and social challenges, but he's connected to us. He's back with us, and we're seeing him achieve things we never thought possible. And that's our miracle of healing. My personal experience suggests that when it comes to accurate diagnosis of underlying conditions associated with autism, the earlier is far better than later, but it is never, ever too late to unlock all that your child is able to do. For those who are silently seizing and are treated early with anti-seizure medications, I can share the endorsement of many renowned physicians in the field of autism that many of these children begin to show incredible gains in expressive language, comprehension, and many are starting to speak and to learn. And in some cases, IQ points are even rising measurably. These children can become indistinguishable from their same-age peers, attend regular school classes. But I also feel that any step we take forward is a valuable step forward for our children. Dr. Fernando Miranda is a brilliant neurologist who founded the Bright Minds Institute in California and works with children who have autism. Dr. Miranda has shared that many of the patients who come to him with a diagnosis of autism are actually experiencing silent partial seizures. Many of Dr. Miranda's patients are getting the correct diagnosis using what he has called a deep EEG, which shows these hidden seizures. This newer technology uses many more leads and is more able to locate the deep electrical discharges, whereas a traditional EEG is more on the surface. Hopefully, someday, this improved technology will be available to all children who are receiving the diagnosis of autism. Recently, Dr. Miranda was interviewed by Claire Shipman from ABC News. I'll give you the website to watch this clip, but he talks about how treating seizures with medication aimed at seizure control has produced a now astounding results. And his website is www.brightmindsinstitute.com. And if you go to that, you'll be able to see his interview. For those children who have a genetic syndrome that includes seizures, and many of them do, treating that seizure component, again, has led to dramatic improvements in their lives. And we are so fortunate to live in a time where we're finally getting this information out in the open. And I'm so happy to be able to share this with many of you. So you go to the doctor and you say, I think my child's having seizures. And the doctor looks at you and says, nothing showed up on EEG, and is not convinced that your child has seizures. In our case, we were told that's how autistic children behave. He's handicapped. You need to accept that. Unless he drops and has a seizure on the floor of my office, I'm not going to prescribe any medications. So what do you do? I'm going to share with you a process that I created to help you start to gather data based on what you see. And then you can share this information with your child's doctor, because a doctor is more likely to listen to you if you can hand them black and white data versus, I just have that funny feeling something's wrong. And this, a lot of people get scared when you start to talk about data and numbers, but I'll show you, it's very easy to work with. So I'm going to take a step back for a second, and there's four reasons people engage in behavior. The first is because they want to get someone's attention. The second is because we want something. We want the cookie. We want the glass of juice. We want to play outside. The third is because we want to get out of doing something. We're being asked to do something, and we want to avoid it at all cost. And the last is doing something because it just feels good to us. All of these behaviors, all behaviors are tied to these four functions. The clue is, if you can't tie a behavior to these functions, this gives you some very important reasons behind a behavior. Because if the reasons for behavior do not fit what you're seeing, you have reason to suspect a seizure disorder. A lot of us like a good mystery, trying to figure out the pieces and trying to solve what the whodunit. And that's similar to what I'm going to walk you through. We're going to look at a lot of different pieces, and as we prove and disprove those, we can assign them to those sides of the columns and help us to clarify the picture of seizures. So we need to ask questions and discard the reasons that don't fit, but keep the ones that do. So some of the basic questions we need to ask ourselves is really looking at the environment for a child. Are they hungry? Did they take their medication that day? Is their medication wearing off? Did they sleep last night? Are they getting sick? All those environmental pieces, how do you even start to figure all that out? Well, one of the simple data collection tools you can use is called a scatter plot. Here's a sample of a scatter plot, and what it is, it's just a chart broken down by days and times. And when you observe the child and you see a behavior you think might be seizure-related, you just put an X in that time block. You continue to do this over a couple of weeks, and after a couple of weeks, then you can look and say, okay, do we have a pattern? Is there anything that jumps out at me? Here's a sample of some behavioral episodes. So do we see more behaviors in the morning or the afternoon? Are they happening more often before lunch, after lunch? Medications being given at 11 o'clock every day. Well, is it happening around that time? Is it more toward the beginning of the week, the end of the week? So just looking at something like this is going to help you to weed out, oh, you know what, they're having that behavior every day 20 minutes before snack time. So that may be, you know what, they're hungry. So it's going to help us to more refine what we're looking at. So now that you've been able to eliminate a few of your causes through the scatter plot, we're going to go back to those functions of behavior. You need to move on to take a look at what's called an antecedent behavior consequence data tool. But really all this does is you're looking at what happens before, after, and during a behavior. And it helps us to link the reasons and causes for behavior. So an example might be if the teacher says it's time for math, which would be your antecedent, the child starts to scream and yell and tantrum, that's your behavior, and the teacher responds with, okay, we'll do math later. That's the consequence. But looking at that, you can see a clear chain of events. What happened before? Teacher says it's math time. Child has a tantrum. Teacher takes the activity away. And what that actually is, to go even further, would be those functions that I mentioned would be escape. It's the child's way of avoiding having to do their math activity. So here's just a sample of an ABC, or an antecedent behavior consequence chart. A student's told to go to lunch, they flop on the floor, and they don't go to the lunchroom. A student is asked to put a preferred toy away, they throw the toy and start to yell, and the teacher takes the toy away. Teacher says it's time for snack, the student goes and gets their snack, goes to their desk, and has their snack. But in all three of those examples, you can see how those events connect. With behaviors that are seizure-related, you won't find those connections. You won't be able to nicely line them up. So if you have behaviors that you can't line up with an antecedent, the behavior and the consequence, again, this is giving you more information that there may be some seizures going on. This is just a blank ABC data sheet. There's many generic ones available on the Internet. The ones that Karen and I are using will be available on our website in the next few weeks, and I'll give you that address at the end of the presentation that you'll be able to download and use. So we now have some solid data, and we have to start looking, is there a connection? So there's a two-step process using your information. What you look at is the behaviors that were present with a cause. Now, one of the things I suggest that you start out with is looking at the child's cognitive skills, self-stimulatory behaviors, aggression, and communication. And this is where you basically collect information on what is their cognitive skill. They are able to say what happened during an event. They can follow two-step directions. They can understand when they're angry but not hurt people. Self-stimulatory, jumping up and down. So this really is going to break down what it looks like in a typical behavior that you know connects to a function. What does their aggression look like? Do they punch? Do they hit? Do they scream? So it's really important to have this is almost kind of your baseline information to make comparisons to. So as you're collecting your ABC data, what you'll start to see is you'll have behaviors that are presenting without cause. So you've been able to eliminate the episodes that occur because of environmental factors, functions, the reasons behind them, and then what are typical responses. You're then going to be left with this core of behaviors that don't make any sense. And what I suggest is you start to compile them by date, location, time, all those defining factors that are going to help a doctor to take a better look at your child. So the first example is in November of 2011, student was unable to be redirected from going after staff, did not remember the incident when it was done. Their eyes had kind of a different look to them. They went to sleep after the event. So these are the things that we saw that were not along the norms of what we said is behaviors that were present with cause, or the behaviors that we described as more of a baseline of where our child typically was. But as you look, you'll see each of the examples, there are more and more behaviors that we became aware of. So by February, we were noticing things such as his eyes were shifting to the left and rapidly blinking with a fixed gaze. We tried to ask him questions. He didn't answer us. We noticed his mouth was starting to twitch, but he continued to stare. So all these things were things we hadn't seen in his typical behaviors, but we couldn't connect them to any of the functions or anything in the environment either. So again, this gave us hard data. And here's a continuing of that episode, behaviors that we're seeing. It was not able to follow directions, was not able to go to the front door and get his coat. He didn't recognize me when I walked in the room. And then smaller staring spells occurred throughout the hour that was following, lasting with some confusion. So again, now you've narrowed it down to this whole list that you can't explain away. There's no logical reason for what you've done. This is just an additional list of some other behaviors that just were odd, that we just started to generate a list of. Things like his leg twitching, his throat clearing, tapping his head and saying, ouch, peripheral staring spells. But the interesting thing is if you take these odd behaviors and you lay them against that list that I mentioned earlier of seizure-related behaviors, they're identical. There's no disputing that this is not a seizure disorder. One of the other tools that you can use that I was recently introduced to is the Rancho Levels of Cognitive Functioning, which were created at the Ranchos Los Amigos Medical Center in California, and I've included the website. But what they do is it's a scale of 1 to 10 that describes level of cognitive functioning, where 1, the person's not responding, they need complete support, they're not responding to heat, cold, pain, just no stimulation is having an impact on them. As you head up to number 5, they're confused and they're not agitated, but if you get to 10, it's purposeful and appropriate. So by using this scale, you can reference where your child is in these behavioral episodes. Are they slightly agitated or are they not responding? And again, it's giving you just more information, more hard data. And doctors respond much more favorably when you have that data to hand to them versus just saying, this is what I think is going on. So this scale is a wonderful tool, and I encourage you to check out their website as they have a lot of information on looking at the levels of cognitive functioning and on just activity in the brain in general. So if we move along to analyze your data, so now you've got your scatter plot, you've got your ABC, you've got your baseline of what the child typically is like, and you have this list of unexplained things. Do you see any more patterns? Can you explain anything away? By this point, you've explained everything you can away, and you're left with this core of seizure-like behaviors. What you need to do at that point is then follow your gut instinct, because then you know something is not right. Something is not staying the course. It's not making sense. The hardest part about approaching the medical professionals, as I mentioned, is our family went through 5 different neurologists until we finally got a neurologist who was willing to listen to us. So these are the suggestions that I make to really make sure that doctors are willing to listen. First, write up all your data. So the charts that are available on our website and the ones that I've shown in this presentation, make copies of those. Document the time, the date. Did someone get hurt? What were all those little odd behaviors? Because if you give it to them, they've got it as a point of reference. 2, if you can catch an episode on video, do it. And put it on a DVD and take it to the doctor. Even catching it on your iPhone and playing it back to the doctor, they were able to then look and they can say, oh, see, their eyes are rolling to the left. Oh, look at their leg is twitching. It gives you more hardcore evidence to prove that something's going on. And 3, one thing that I think is really important is what I have found is many doctors want to review the episode individually. So they want to look at each episode as a separate event. And what you really need to do is encourage them to review all of these seizures and episodes that have been happening longitudinally, kind of going over the span of time, because when you start to compare those pieces to each other is when you really start to see these patterns emerge. So what if they say no? The doctor says, no, you're crazy. Mom, you're nuts. Dad, forget it. I'm not doing this. Find a new neurologist. I mean, we live in a society where we're afraid to break up with our hairdresser because we might offend them. You have to find a new neurologist. Many, many people who I've talked to and who I've worked with have said they have seen many, many doctors and have been turned away. But don't give up. You will find that doctor who's willing to listen to you. I promise you, you will. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share this information. You can check out our website. Karen and I have a website, which is www.silenceseizing.com. I've also included my email address if you want to contact me further with some questions. We also provide consultation for a nominal fee. And Minta, I'll turn it back over to you for questions.
Thank you so much, Tricia. That was really interesting. I've been hanging on your every word. fascinating. We've got some great questions here. Now, I want to remind you, if you're dialing in, please. You can ask a question by just hitting star 2. You can email your questions. You can give me your questions by dialing star 2, that's raising your hand, and I will call on you. We've got some, this is such a very complex issue, Tricia. So I know you, we've got some pretty, we've got a long, the first question is a pretty long question, so I'm going to read it slow.
Okay.
This is from Linda in Pristina, Kosovo. And she says, hi, my name is Linda. My son Don, who is 16, has CDD form of autism. We live in Pristina, Europe. However, he was diagnosed at Yale. 4 years ago, he started to have seizures caused by epilepsy. First year on medication, he didn't have any seizures. After a year, he started to have seizures again. Then the doctor added the second medication. He would have to have seizures from time to time, and mostly he would be sick with flu. 8 months ago, his doctor changed the medication again from Lamictal to Topamax, and about 6 months now, he didn't have any seizures. However, he's now having some kind of nervous breakdown, tantrums, violent behaviors, I don't know how to call it, time to time, maybe once a week, and it lasts for like 10 minutes. His face turns blue, and he has uncontrolled behavior. My question is, can this be silent seizures, as I've never seen him like this before? Thank you, Linda.
I'm not a doctor, but it's certainly, you know, it sounds like it's quite possible. You know, one of the things that's really difficult is getting the medication cocktail just right for people who have the seizures. Very often they do have to switch from the different types of medications to really get the therapeutic coverage. One of the things that I notice in the question is the statement about being sick with the flu.
That's what caught my attention, yes.
Because what's really important is that any type of illness lowers your threshold for seizures. So when someone has seizures and they become ill, it is much more likely those seizures will come out. So that's one thing that kind of caught my attention looking at that. What I would do, again, I mean, I'm a little concerned with his face is turning blue.
Mm-hmm.
Because that certainly speaks to something neurological. But I would, again, go back and look at just how I talked about breaking down those behaviors. Looking at those behaviors that are just the silent seizures that seem to be coming out now, really looking at is there a reason behind them? Is there something you can connect them to? And really looking at the breaking down the behavior. Are you seeing things like his eyes rolling? Are you seeing things, you know, parts of his body twitching? Is he remembering after something that happened? And really, as I mentioned, seizures tend to be very patterned. So look for things within these episodes that are reflective of the seizures he had previously. And that will give you some good insight into whether or not they're reemerging. So I would look at the illness piece and then looking for those patterns to see if they mimic the previous seizures.
Right. So it sounds like she could benefit a lot by getting that chart off of your website and charting the days and times and the strange behavior that he's exhibiting. Am I correct?
Yep. Yes. That's absolutely. To start really trying to figure out, do they connect to anything? And start to make that list of behaviors with cause and behaviors without cause. And you should be able to match up pretty easily which column they fall into. But based on the history, because that's the other piece I mentioned, is really taking it over time, my guess would be that, yes, these are probably another form of seizure because they can manifest in different ways in different parts of the brain.
Yes. I'm getting a lot of questions of things like of that nature. Michelle from Fresno asks, could spells of extreme uncontrollable laughter be seizures?
There actually is a type of seizure called a galactic seizure. It's GELASTIC, and it is characterized by uncontrollable laughing. It's actually a form of a seizure. So absolutely, and that is something that I've seen in lots of children I've worked with, and people always say, oh, they're just processing something from an hour ago. Not necessarily. So that is a type of seizure.
Hmm. interesting. Here's another one with fevers and seizures. Gina from Petersburg says, I believe that my son has had blank staring seizures when he has a real high fever. An MRT, I'm not sure what that is, but an MRT showed nothing serious, and the doctor said not to worry. This has only happened once before that I'm aware of. Is he correct? I'm wondering if she's saying, is it something she should worry about?
Well, again, I think it's, we know that when there's illness, that lowers the seizure threshold. What I would suggest is, again, starting to collect information on when it happens. Now, it sounds like it's not happening that frequently that she's aware of. There are different types of seizures that only happen when you're sleeping. So they could be occurring, or they could be happening so briefly that she's not seeing them. So that's when you really have to start to take that data, and you can look for the more subtle signs. You know, are they chewing on the inside of their lip? Are there times when he's doing that? Because that can be a sign of a seizure, chewing on the inside of your mouth. Is he clicking his tongue? Are his eyes turned off to one direction? It's those real subtle, subtle things. And you really have to be a detective because they're not very obvious. So you really have to watch for them. But, you know, I think this is where, even though I'm saying use your data, follow your gut instinct, and not all doctors are knowledgeable about these type of seizures. I have been astounded at how many doctors I have spoken to and the doctors that I worked with for my son that I've educated on this that had no idea these things even existed. So the doctor may very
much be... Isn't that crazy when we have to educate the doctors?
And that's what it ends up being. And so this doctor, you know, could be a wonderful doctor, but in his experience and background, I don't think it's anything, you know, important. It's nothing you need to worry about. However, the vast majority of doctors have no idea about these types of seizures and how they manifest. And, you know, often when you try and have the discussion, they will look at you like you are the crazy parent. And
yes.
Bottom line is, I had doctors come back to me and say, you know what, you taught me a thing or two. That's okay. And it's finding those doctors that are willing to have that conversation with you.
It's good that they acknowledged that many doctors will just be very dismissive. And I really liked what you said about finding, you know, a doctor that will work with you and respect you. And that's so important, you know, because we are our children's own best experts. Their doctors don't know us like we do. And I think it's so important for a doctor to listen to you.
No, the doctor, the one neurologist that we ended up finally, who's really helped us, she looked at me and said, I don't understand the autism piece. I get the seizure piece. I'm not 100% buying what you're saying, but let me look at the information. And she came back a few weeks later and said, I'm convinced. And what she ended up doing was actually, as I mentioned, the EEGs often don't pick up anything. Another tip that I would give parents, too, is make sure that a neurologist is reading the EEG, because often a tech will read it, and they don't see anything. If there's no glaring errors, they won't notice. What the neurologist noticed with ours is when she really took it apart, there was a very small section where my son's brain waves were slowing, and that indicated the seizure. But it was so subtle that the four people before who looked at it said it was normal. It wasn't until she really, as the doctor, went through and took it apart that she found that.
Wow, so it sounds very important, though. You get an EEG, you have to take that back to your doctor and have them look at it. Now, I have to interject to hear a little personal story. I'm going to get right back to the questions.
Mm-hmm.
But my son, Kyle, who I talk about a lot, he used to have, they're less frequent now, but he used to have like these just blank stare, like he would just blank out, his eyes would glaze over. And I was convinced that he was having silent seizures and took him for an EEG. And I was told that that was normal. And that makes me just want to run back to that.
Yeah,
this was 5 years ago. It makes me want to get that EEG and bring it to a neurologist and say, do you see anything here? Because the technician didn't. That is brilliant. Maybe people in the audience who have had these EEGs that were told were normal might think about having a doctor read this EEG. It should be standard practice.
It should be. And again, it's, you know, as on a personal, stepping off my soapbox for a minute, you know, really, doctors don't want to be told that they're wrong.
Absolutely.
So it's tough to do, but, you know, if you can keep, you know, thick skin, and if you're not going to advocate for your child, no one's going to. And,
you're so right.
You know, they eventually you will find somebody who sits down and says, you know what, this is what I saw. And bottom line is once you have someone, one of the doctors that we worked with laid everything out, and he said, when you lay all of this out, there's no denying this is a classic seizure disorder. I can't believe anybody missed it.
Unbelievable.
But it's getting those pieces, bringing in those little pieces that you collect and eventually building a case. I feel like you're almost building a case like you're going to court.
Mm-hmm.
And you're bringing all your documents and all your evidence, and, okay, now put it together. So that's, you know, that's what families are having to do, and they're having a tremendous amount of success, and kids are getting better.
That is that is just a tremendous piece that you bring to us. I've got some really great, more great questions.
Okay.
I want to get back to. From Oklahoma City, you are describing my son to a T right now. He just had an emergency EEG because the doctors and psychologists felt this new behavior were actually seizures. The EEG said they were not seizures, so we were back at square one. I don't know how many more times my heart can take him grabbing his head and crying. What is wrong with me? Sounds just like your son. I wish
mm-hmm.
it were the old days when I loved you. What can we do to get this deep EEG done?
Well, that's where I would suggest if you can get the EEG and have another doctor, have another neurologist look at it, get a second opinion looking at it. And again, we went through four doctors before we got someone who actually read it the way it was supposed to be read.
What I'm hearing from this patient, I'm sorry to interrupt, what I'm hearing from this person in Oklahoma City is what the last thing they said is, what can we do to get this deep EEG done? I get the feeling they had
sorry,
the other part of
the
EEG.
Dr. Miranda.
What can we do? Yes.
Okay. Dr. Miranda is out in California at the Bright Minds Institute. You can contact him through his website, and they can give you more information as to how to do that. Really, as far at this point, he's the only one that has this and is specializing in it. So that would be my best advice to get that done. But, again, I would continue to collect the information like I've talked about because, again, it's not feasible for everybody to fly to California and have that done.
Right.
But, you know, hopefully that technology will eventually spread where it's available to all kids who are diagnosed with autism. But I would contact the Bright Minds Institute.
Great advice. You know, let's hope that becomes more. Let's hope that
yep.
you will bring more awareness to this in Oklahoma City. Don't give up.
No.
Get an deep EEG and hang in there. It'll get better. Kristen from San Clemente. Yes, thank you. Kristen from San Clemente has a very good question. Can low blood sugar be a trigger for seizures? My ASD son seems to have explosive behaviors when he is hungry. He is irrational, irritable, and often aggressive during those outbursts. They can last 5 to 30 plus minutes. After he eats and calms down, he is a different person, apologetic, etc. So can low blood sugar be a trigger for seizures?
It's not necessarily a trigger for seizures, but it can definitely set off a chain of behaviors. And prior to us going into figuring out my son had seizures, we investigated the blood sugar piece. And that was something we did look into. And it's if their blood pressure crashes because of low sugar and they haven't eaten, absolutely you can see a manifestation of similar behaviors. What it comes down to is, again, looking at the list of behaviors that tend to be more seizure-based. Are you seeing the eye rolling? Are you seeing the chattering of teeth? Are you seeing twitching of body parts? And what is their memory after? Because that's also a really important piece. Are they remembering the pieces that what happened? Or are they completely confused and disoriented? You really have to look at what they call the post-ictal state, which is right after the seizure. Looking at, are they confused? Are they tired? Are they disoriented? Because that's almost just as important as the behaviors you see during the episode. So that will also let you know if it's the behaviors are are they really behavior with a reason, as I said, or are they the seizure behaviors? Because you will have a post-ictal state if it's a seizure.
Well, she says he gets apologetic. Kristen, my advice is give him frequent snacks for now and maybe get a test for blood sugar, see if he might have hypoglycemia.
I mean, you can do that. You can, you know, break it down where he's getting 6 meals and, you know, so that blood sugar stays stable and collect the data as I suggested. You know, listing those behaviors, was there, you know, do your ABC analysis. Was there a reason? Was there a cause? Does it stabilize out? You can also use the scatter plot and mark in exactly where the child's eating and then put X's in, and you should be able to see a pattern emerge when it's happening in relation to when they're eating. That will also help you very easily tease that piece out.
Good advice. It seems like anybody out there who, if you suspect your child might have a seizure disorder, then these charts might really be very helpful to you. I'm going to start one myself tonight, I think. I want to remind the audience again, please, I don't see any hands raised. So if you're dialing in, this would be such a great opportunity for you to ask Patricia a question. If you even suspect that your child may have a seizure disorder, please call in, dial *2 to raise your hand, speak to Patricia directly. And I'm going to now take one more question for now. But I really want to encourage you guys to call in. I think we've answered all of the questions. I think that we've answered all of the questions that I have coming in. So while I'm waiting for another question to come in, let me ask you, there was one question that from Monica from Houston again. She wants to know how seizures affect a person with autism. Let me read you her whole question. My son is a low-functioning person with autism. He is 17 years old. He started having seizures, tonic-clonic seizures, for the last year. Will he ever come out of them, and how do seizures affect a person with autism?
Okay. Well, starting with how they affect them, one of the biggest things that you often see is a regression in skills, because the bottom line is when you have a seizure, it's a brain injury. It's an injury to your brain. And we also have to kind of look at it in that respect as well, is that each time our kid sees, the brain is being injured. And a lot of times you'll see a regression in their language skills. My son went from speaking in 7 and 8 word phrases and chunks down to 1 word at a time. We were getting 1 word responses, and they were not very clear. The skills that they may have in terms of their life skills, being able to, you know, read a simple book or to make a recipe or fold laundry, things like that, you'll see a reduced ability to do that independently, almost like they've forgotten that skill. If you have a child who you can say, you know what, go get your coat at the front door and your backpack and meet me at the car, and now they're walking to the door to get their coat and they're just standing there staring at the ceiling because they have no idea what you've said, you see regression in those skills. You also may see a reduced tolerance for things. That frustration tolerance may be very, very low. It doesn't take much to upset the apple cart, so to speak. So when you see those kinds of things, and some other things that you also can see that may not necessarily be the person with autism, is there are some physical symptoms that you may see. There can be a change in the person's skin tone. There have been children, and I know my son was one, where he would turn almost a yellowish color. There was almost a yellowish, like jaundice cast to his skin in the weeks leading up to having a seizure. So things like that, but you really start, the big thing is you see a regression in the skills that they had, that things just start to disappear. As I mentioned in the one slide, things start to flow away from them, and you start to see all these things that they had, all these great skills and abilities are gone. It's like, well, wait a minute. you know how to do X, Y, and Z. How come you can't remember how to brush your teeth or you can't remember how to find your locker? You knew how to do this. That's the big thing that you'll see in people with autism. And again, the seizures cause those behaviors. So you may start to see a huge increase in challenging behaviors that you didn't see before. Again, that's where the charts and graphs and everything are really, really important, because you may, a lot of times what I find too, especially with the teen years, is people will blame the behaviors on hormones. They're in puberty. That's what happens when kids with autism go through puberty. So again, it's really, it's looking at what is typical for your child and what is different now. And that's really the best way to measure it in people with autism. And, I, you know, the rest of the question in terms of will they ever come out of them, it's really hard to say. I mean, the brain is amazing in the way it can heal itself and the things that it can do. But, you know, in some cases, children are on seizure medication their whole lives. Sometimes they're able to stay on the same dose, same cocktail, same brand. Other people are having to change every 6 months. It's kind of an ongoing battle. I don't think you can ever be complacent and think they're gone, because I have found that when you are like, yay, they're gone, all of a sudden one pops up and you're like, oh, we're back to square one. So I don't think they ever completely disappear, but the regression is definitely how it impacts our kids the most.
That is such a helpful tip. We really do have to be so observant of our children, and it's easy in the day-to-day to lose that. That chart sounds like such a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
We have some callers on the line now.
Okay.
I would like to speak to Walia Inderjit from Houston, Texas. Walia, are you on the line with me? Wait, hold on. Oops, sorry. Walia, can you hear us?
Yes.
Hi, Walia. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question for Patricia?
Yes, actually, you were giving my answer, regarding my son who is having seizures. And yes, you gave me the right answer, because you're talking about like a regression.
Mm-hmm.
His personality totally changed after starting having seizures.
Yep.
He has so much of the sensory needs now. His frustration level is very high right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets into the anger mode, and he starts shaking and all that. Right now, he didn't have any seizures since November the 9th, but that's, we added the sleep medicine to it because we were feeling he was on risperidone first, and then we took him off to put him on to the Abilify, and the doctors told us was that because we took him off from risperidone, that's why he's not sleeping well. So that's why he was having like every 15 days, and then every 3 weeks we kept on increasing the trileptal dose, and it didn't help him. But then we put him into the trizodone for the sleep, and since then, so far, touch wood, he didn't have anyone. But definitely, we are experiencing a lot of sensory needs right now. And it's like he's totally changed personality. Is there anything you can help me with?
No, and that's, you know, typically then once the seizures are under control and everything has stabilized, often you'll start to see those things kind of fade away and you'll get more of your typical child that you knew back. But I have found when you're in the flux of changing medications and there's a lot of changes going on, that is often when your children almost become, they're unstable too. And you'll see things that are just not out of the norm for them. It takes time for the medications to stabilize, for their brain and their body to stabilize, because these are serious injuries to their body.
It is.
And it really disrupts everything about you, your sensory, your systems, all those things. So,
and
once
he has lost a lot of weight also.
I'm sorry?
He has lost a lot of weight also. He was already a thin, lean boy, and now you can see it. Everybody's asking me, like, is he okay? Like, that much weight he has lost.
Well, and I would question, too, with that, is you said that he went off risperidol?
Yes. Like,
risperidol,
last summer, we took him off from the risperidol, and he was put on to the Abilify.
Well, the rest, I know with Risperdal, one of the huge concerns when children are put on Risperdal is it causes them to gain a tremendous amount of weight.
And
when you take them off, they lose. They can, even if they didn't gain a lot of times when they take it off, then they start to drop a lot of weight. It's kind of your body, again, that restabilizing.
So how much time, do you know how much time it's going to take? Because he is underweight right now.
Yeah.
He is 5'11", and he is like 114 or 115 pounds.
Okay. Is he a picky eater?
No, he's a very good eater.
He's a good
and
eater.
And he is a healthy eater. He's not a pizza person. He's a soup salad person.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, you know, I always use this kind of a time frame, and again, I'm not a doctor, but I usually give, you need to give the body a good 6 months to really stabilize from a medication change.
And the seizure-free, right?
Yes, yes. Really getting that body back to stable, and then, you know, and that can take, it can take 6 months. It can, you know, sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's less, but it really is, the body has to go back to finding its balance.
Okay. But in the meantime, in the school or so, can you give us any advice? Because we went back to, because teachers were unable to control him, so we were having a lot of troubles. We kind of come back with the remedy was, let's just shorten his day. So we started picking him like an hour early.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because you have a teaching background, I just want to ask you, because
I
so far I have been hearing all those webinars. I found your one is the best one, very interesting, and the slides and all structured very beautifully. Like, yes, you can say, like, yeah, you're a teacher with, yeah, who has autism background.
Yep.
I can say that. I really appreciate your webinar.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's, you know, we went through the same thing with my son where we ended up, I took a leave of absence from work, and he only went to school 3 days a week. And then for a while, he was only going half days. And really, that was when we were trying to stabilize the medication because he was so dangerous. He dislocated the shoulder of one of the staff in the room. He bit the principal.
Okay.
I mean, he was so dangerous. And what school was telling us was, we're just going to restrain him and hold him to the ground when this happens, which
and
you can't
yes.
for a medical condition. That's not what you do. So
yeah, and
really,
the other problem with my son is also that because you said the restraint, so he can't handle the restraint either. He becomes very furious.
Mm-hmm,
he gets those anger things inside, like that rage comes out of him. It takes him, then I have to keep him home for a week and that to calm down his rage. To calm down his rage, I have to bring out the strength from myself inside, like emotional strength, keep him calm.
And it's, I mean, that, again, would say that his medication is not stabilized, and I would question if you're still seeing those rages, then either the dosage is not right or he's not on the right medication or they have changed too many things, too many medications, you know, going off the Risperdal, adding the Abilify. You know, there seems to be, I mean, there's at least four medications you've mentioned that have been changed or altered. So that can also complicate things. Doctors should really only change one thing at a time and give it some time. So it's also kind of hard to look and say, okay, is it that he is on the Abilify? Is it, you know, the Trileptal went up? It's hard to break those pieces down. It seems like a lot of changes were made in a short period of time. And that's, again, that's also, it doesn't take much. And when you're on different medications can lower that threshold and make seizures more common.
Okay.
So you might need to step back and really take a look at the medications and really advocate for only changing one at a time. The teacher in me, it's the best way, I mean, safety is a priority. What we did is I've helped kids in schools, the teachers create safety plans. So when the child starts to do something or starts to get upset, they have almost like a fire drill evacuation procedure to get the other kids out of the room. I mean,
so
that everybody knows what to do and everybody knew who to call, and the teachers and the principals in the building all had walkie-talkies that they would call so extra people could come help. I mean, we really created like a fire drill plan.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we are working on right now, because his art is on Monday, that behavior continuum for him, and that is 20 pages long. So we are watching each and everything, when he does this and do this and all that. Because I'm just like end off, because keep telling them what to do and still not following through. So this is what we came up with. So we are going to present that to them
so that we
should follow that.
Here's my other question, is, which is probably a little bit off topic, but does he have a behavior consultant? Somebody who can go in and do that for you, because it might carry more weight.
The ABA person, no. No.
No.
I do have an in-home trainer who has the training in that ABA and stuff, and I myself went through, and that's what we are working together to see.
Great.
That's how we are working.
That sounds like a great plan, because you're being proactive.
Yeah, that's what we want.
Great. I'm sorry to interrupt, but in the interest of time, I'm going to ask you guys to just say a few more closing words to each other. We have a lot of callers calling in.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Do you have any other questions, Wavya?
No, that's it.
Thank you so much for calling in. You brought up such wonderful points. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story with us. Okay, are you still there with me?
I'm here.
Trisha, you're here? Okay, I guess
you're here.
Very good. Okay, she hung up. Very good. Okay, we have another caller waiting on the line, Nathan Aaron from Demona. And Nathan, can you hear me? Hold on. Nathan, are you on the line with us? Nathan?
Yes, can you hear me?
Hi, Nathan. Yes, I can hear you, Nathan. Hi,
hello.
Thank you for calling in. Hi, do you have a question for Trisha?
Yes, I would like to know, how long do laughing spells have to continue for it to be considered a galactic seizure, or possibility of being a galactic seizure?
They can be very short, from 5 to 10 seconds, or they can be, you know, an uncontrollable laughing fit that's, you know, 15 minutes long. There's really no specific time that qualifies it. It's more just the evidence of it happening. But, again, it's going through and figuring out that it's not related to anything.
And does it always have to have a sardonic nature, or can it seem like regular laughter, like, you know, I don't know how to say, you know, just regular laughter in terms of being happy as opposed to, you know, someone laughing, but looking like they're visibly not enjoying it?
I mean, I think it comes down to really knowing what those typical characteristics are. How does the child behave when they're, you know, it's something that's happiness? And I would pay real close attention to how it sounds, what their facial expression looks like, what their body's doing. When you know it's more they're happy because they've got their favorite show, or you know, they're doing something outside they enjoy, versus those episodes, and then see if you can compare, you know, do they have the same look on their face? And then looking for those subtle symptoms, again, those subtle things with different body parts moving, twitching, things like that, that will give you more information. It's really about observing and knowing what's typical in the child and then what doesn't fit into the realm of what's typical for them.
Okay, thank you very much. As
sure.
would have it, someone called in right as you began to answer, but I think I got most of what you said.
Oh, okay. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you so much for calling. Thank you. Okay. We're going to go back to the phone, back to our email questions. People have been very... I want to make sure I don't hear Nathan anymore. Oh, very good. Thank you. Okay. Trisha, you are so on. Thank you so much for being so helpful to my callers. From Jennifer from Wadsworth, Ohio. Now, I've got some questions that are a little complicated here and very fascinating. Jennifer from Ohio says, my son will frequently wake up in the middle of the night, start screaming and biting his arm. He will also sometimes have episodes like this during the day that seem to come out of nowhere. When I try to talk to him during these episodes, he does frequently respond to me by looking at me. He's nonverbal. but could this still be a seizure? He also frequently seems to have headaches, and I am wondering if this could be related as well. These episodes often increase when we have a storm system moving through, and I am wondering if weather shifts can be triggers for seizures.
Well, it could be a seizure. The other thing I would question are migraines. That was something else that we looked into as well, because often our kids can have migraines. And if you talk to anybody who works in education, they will tell you that when the barometric pressure changes, kids have behavior. It's without fail, that and the phases of the moon. It really does disrupt their systems. Seizures, again, can frequently happen at night when we're not aware of them. So I would definitely be concerned about the waking up, the screaming, and the biting. But again, you're going to have to tease out what could be nightmare versus what could be seizure. But if it's also happening during the day, again, that's when you're going to look at those behaviors. Now, some of the more simple seizures that can happen, the child will turn and attend to you. They may be able to turn and attend to you and look in your direction. But that doesn't mean a seizure is not still happening in their head. So, yes, the weather can affect it. They do happen a lot at night, and they can attend and look at you.
I never knew that. Thank you. I have another question here from another Jennifer from Orlando. Jennifer from Orlando wants to know, my son is 17, and you have described what I've seen for him for many years. I have asked doctors about his behavior being related to seizures and was told no over and over.
Mm-hmm.
He would have episodes where suddenly, without cause, he was literally jumping off tops of furniture or hurt his sister by jumping up and down on her. Immediately after the episodes, he would be lethargic and did not know what had happened. He did have EEGs and all indicated abnormal findings, yet none were diagnosed with seizures. He has never had a normal EEG. Currently, he has similar behaviors, yet not as intense and not near as frequent. When these episodes slowed, he improved on all developmental levels.
Mm-hmm. That would, to me...
It's a long question. Can you address that first? I'm sorry. That was a long question. Can you address that, and then we'll get to the second half?
It definitely sounds descriptive of what these silent seizures would be like, especially when you're seeing that there's cognitive loss when the behaviors are more frequent, and then when the behaviors the episodes have eased up, there's been behavioral or cognitive growth. So it definitely sounds like that the seizures are happening, and they do tend to wax and wane. You may have a whole lot of them for a couple weeks, and then you may not have any for a couple months. So what she's describing pattern-wise definitely fits a seizure disorder of the silent seizures.
Okay, the second part of her question is, I already have tons of documented data, which I have presented many times to doctors, and while his episodes are not as frequent, they still continue. Do you have suggestions on how to get a doctor to listen, even when you have provided written data and have recorded numerous EEGs, which have been presented to doctors, which show abnormalities but no active seizures during EEGs?
See, one of the other things I haven't mentioned, that sometimes you can actually ask a doctor to, if you can get one to work with you, to say, okay, I know you're saying you don't believe me, but some doctors will actually do a trial of anti-seizure medication. And if you can ask them to do that, sometimes they'll do a trial run with you, and you would continue to take the data to see if you're seeing changes. And sometimes they'll take that as the evidence that the medication seemed to improve the symptoms. It's a long shot. But I have had families who have ultimately, after going to doctor, have been able to do that, do a trial of an anticonvulsant. The child improves on the anticonvulsant, and the doctor uses that, parents are able to use that as kind of the strong arm to say something's going on.
Good advice. Good advice. Mary from Happy Valley Goose Bay asks, my son was diagnosed epileptic when he was 3. He was having 4 different types of seizures. Mm-hmm. When we thought he wasn't seizing, he was carrying on conversations with the technologist, playing with toys, etc. His EEG showed constant seizure activity. This was when he was 3 and epilepsy runs in our family. He was able to stop his medication when he was 7 and his EEG is now clear. He's never had violent tendencies, but he does laugh uncontrollably, right back to that, sometimes and forgets things very easily. Has language delays with comprehension and stuff. He was diagnosed with PDD at age 9. It seems to be an increasing issue, not getting any better. Should we go back to his neurologist to discuss the possibility that his seizures have either returned or continued and are causing brain trauma?
Absolutely. I would go back to the neurologist. As I mentioned, this is a brain injury. You know, it's impacting their brain. So if he's continuing to have them, it's causing injury to his brain. That has to be established, especially with an accurate diagnosis of epilepsy already and family history. I would make the call Monday morning to absolutely get him back in and get him evaluated as soon as possible, because it's very, very possible that the silent seizures, they fly under the radar. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the whole point. It must be so frustrating for these parents, as it was for you, when you're not being listened to. I want to remind the callers again, once again, please, we have such a fantastic expert here with us. If you have any questions regarding seizures and autism, please, if you're dialing in, press *2. Raise your hand, and you can speak to Tricia yourself. I don't see any other questions, so I may ask you one right now by myself. I don't have the incoming questions, so let me ask you one while I'm waiting. Please submit your questions. These are so, you have been answering the questions just so right on. I'm so happy to hear this. Now, if you happen to suspect your child has a seizure disorder, and how would you you may have already answered this, but since, you know, autism can look so much like seizures, if you see there's a problem with your child and you see symptoms that could be very confusing, where would a parent start? Would they start with, you know, a developmental pediatrician, a neurologist? Where do you think, if you see your child exhibiting some behavior that you just don't understand, what would be a good place to start for a parent?
I think if you have a doctor of some type that you are working with that you have a good relationship with, you can start with them. We started with our pediatrician, just our everyday pediatrician, and from there we went to a psychiatrist who was prescribing my son's behavior medication and said, what do you think? And we started as simple as that, because it's to find somebody who is such an expert, and even to get in with a neurologist, you're looking at months and months and months of waiting. So start with the doctor that you use for everything. And even if they tell you, I don't know, ask them, call a colleague. Can you call someone? We asked our pediatrician, and he said, I have no idea, but let me call a friend of mine who's a neurologist and see what he says. Even starting that simple, it's enough to get the ball rolling, that you can start to get the professionals involved. And then work your way through that, you know, then maybe you can get in and talk to that neurologist or maybe that developmental pediatrician. Sometimes, too, different programs and schools have people that will come in. I know some of the programs here in New York where I am, we have developmental pediatricians and psychiatrists who schools contract with to come in and actually do this kind of consultation with families. You know, ask other families, get creative with who you can talk to, but even just starting with your pediatrician, you know, your family doctor who you see and say, okay, you don't know, tell me who to go to next. Start with that person that you trust and move from there. You
Good
can
advice.
Start that simply.
Good advice. Now, here's a practical question that I'll throw out. Let's say that you've been advised to give your child a seizure medication, but your child, he may be autistic and having seizures, he may have sensory issues. How would you get a child who doesn't swallow a pill to take his medication?
Oh, there are many, many ways. You know, really, this is a good person to talk to, and I'll give some suggestions, but a good person to talk to is a speech therapist, a speech pathologist. Because they can often help you with swallowing programs and feeding programs that they can help you. And actually, I know there are some agencies and programs that have pill swallowing programs that can teach them. You can get, you know, certainly you can get the medications in a liquid form, which kids don't like. You mix it with, you know, applesauce and this and that and everything else.
Yeah, and then they don't eat it. And then you
they don't eat it, and you've wasted all this money on this, you know, special yogurt that you thought they'd like. I mean, I know many pharmacies do have additives, flavor additives that they can add to the medications. Now, if you're looking at pills, the problem is many of the seizure pills that I have had to use with my son are huge. They're the horse pills.
Oh, God.
Yeah. We will get a pill splitter and break it into four. If you break it into four pieces, it's the size of like half a Tic Tac. And you can put that in applesauce or something. Then it's smaller, it's not as obvious, and it takes a lot of practice. And what you can even do is just practice with them just taking the spoonful of applesauce from you or of yogurt or of ice cream or whatever so that there's not always medication in it. And I have always found it helps to be honest. I don't like to sneak it past them because I think that just sets up some trust issues.
Oh,
and,
absolutely. And you,
know, you
can't
just
sneak it past them either. You know, they're much smarter than that.
They're incredibly
smart.
Yeah, they know. So often what I'll do is, you know, and you can find pictures right on Google of take your medicine and then you get whatever, that basic contingency for behavior. But tell them you're going to take your medicine and it's going to make your head feel better. Be honest with them. Have that conversation with them.
Maybe use a social story.
A social story, absolutely. You know, that this is what you need to do because maybe they can't verbally tell you, but I guarantee you, receptively, they know exactly what's going on.
I'm sure.
So use a social story. Use a visual strip and practice and reinforce. You can also purchase, a lot of times if you talk, there are different companies or if you talk to the pharmacy, you can get empty capsules to practice with. So there's no medication in them. And if you try that, then they're still getting the experience and the practice, but there's no medication in them to harm them. So that's something else you can do.
What great suggestions. We are almost out of time, so I'm going to ask you if you would like to wrap up, and what else would you like to say to our audience? We've got just about 1 minute left, and can you just give us a brief summary and any information you'd like to share?
I just believe that if you feel that your child is having seizures, gather the information and be prepared to fight. You may have to go to a dozen doctors, but I guarantee you when the brain starts to heal, now that I'm at the opposite end of going through this, and we still have to watch my son, and every so often a seizure pops out, but the quality of life that your child will have, and on those days when you're frustrated and you're angry and you just can't move on, remember, it's about making the quality of their life better, and it is so, so worth it in the end. And you will find someone who will listen. It may take a while, but you will find someone.
Thank you so much for all your great advice and encouraging words, Tricia. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And thanks for, you know, thanks for helping, so helpful to our audience. And I hope we'll see you again on our webinar. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, and good night, viewers. Good night. I'll meet you in a half an hour. Thank you. Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.